Hope you're not tired of taxes, because the debate is just getting started. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, October 27th. Good to have you with us. We start today, as we do every Friday, with our weekly wrap, a look at the economic news of the week, and a peek ahead to what next week might have in store for us. A tax bill, a new Fed chair. Today, we've got David Gura from Bloomberg and Sheila Kolhatkar from The New Yorker. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Adrian.
Hi.
I want to start with the GDP. Economic growth was better than expected at 3% last quarter. And I wonder, Sheila, if you can start us off, what's driving that?
Well, it's a very encouraging sign that the storms that people predicted would have a huge impact on the economy did not hurt as much as some economists were expecting. And it appears that consumers are still willing to spend money in spite of, various worrying signs in terms of the global news horizon and what's going on in Washington. So that has played a large part in kind of propping up some of these economic numbers. I think there are people who are going to use this to attack some of the Republicans' key arguments that regulation, for example, is choking off economic growth. It seems that American companies are actually doing fine in the current environment. So that will be interesting to watch.
Any clouds you see in today's report, David?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Commerce Department acknowledged it really can't say how much the storms affected these data. So there's some concern there. And then these are data that are subject to change as time goes on. It's the first read of growth. So we're going to get another read next month, another read the month after that. And when you look at the data, there are indications about inflation as well. There's some price data in there, and that's still coming in below what the Fed would like to see. So there is some weakness therein. It is the first read, but I think that rightfully seen as something that is a good sign for the economy.
I want to move on to the tax plan we're expecting from the GOP next week. The House passed a budget that sort of sets the table for that, but it only passed it by a slim margin. Where do you see the hurdles, David, coming up for this GOP tax plan?
Yeah, we really don't know what's going to be in the tax plan. It's been crafted under a lot of secrecy. The chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Kevin Brady, has done that. He's trying to marshal it through. So next week, he says on Wednesday, we're going to get a look at it. There's a lot that hasn't been defined yet. We've seen some of these controversies emerge about what's going to happen to benefits to 401k contributions, for instance, or the state and local tax deduction. There's stuff that needs to be hammered out. And you look at that vote on the House budget, which is really the Senate budget, and it was by a 4-point margin. So there are clearly people who are concerned about what that tax bill is going to look like. And you've got folks on the Senate who voted for the Senate version of the bill, maybe just to advance the procedure to see what's going to be in the tax bill going forward. So I think a lot has yet to be seen. That's going to be the biggest hurdle, just trying to get something that is going to be pleasing or at least palatable to the right number of congressmen to get it through.
And Sheila, what do you think? I mean, how doable is major tax reform when we see the party as divided as it is right now?
Well, I think in terms of the process that seems to be playing out, this tax debate is starting to mirror the healthcare debate in a lot of ways, both in terms of the people who are likely to benefit from the legislation and the people who are likely to be hurt. I mean, with the healthcare plan that they were trying to push at different points, they were proposing to take healthcare away from large numbers of people. They used a similar process of trying to keep it all very hidden. They didn't speak to any Democrats about it or try to get them on board at all. Their plan was to pass it with only Republican votes, and that did not work out well. So there are people pointing out the fact that, you know, they're pursuing a similar strategy, and it's a little bit worrying because they have very, very little margin to, you know, in terms of votes that they can afford to lose.
Bets on whether or not they can get anything big done? David?
I think the odds are very slim. I mean, we're talking about just a matter of days when you're going to have the House and the Senate together. And we're talking about like 3 weeks for the entire process. And you look back at the last time this happened, it happened over many months. So I think fair to say the odds are slim.
So we've only got about a minute here left, but I want to talk about President Trump's pick for Fed chief. We could see that. We're now expecting that decision next week. Sheila, any bets on who his choice might be?
Well, I think the most important task he has is to not screw things up. And there's a very powerful argument to be made to just kind of keep the status quo, because based on the data, the economy is performing quite well. And Trump seems to enjoy taking credit for that, including the stock market reaching new highs every other day. So there is a risk in terms of making a change that might interrupt that period of improvement. And I'm very curious to see what he does.
David Gura from Bloomberg and Sheila Kolhatkar from The New Yorker. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Adrian.
Thank you.
As we just mentioned, the tax bill countdown has begun. On Wednesday, if all goes according to plan, we'll get a fuller sense of what the GOP has in mind. Corporate tax cuts, tax breaks, which deductions they want to keep and which they want to scrap. One fight that's looking particularly contentious, as David just mentioned, is over the state and local tax deduction. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has our story.
To make it past the deficit hawks, tax cuts have to be offset by getting rid of deductions. And nickel and diming it won't do. Losing the state and local tax deduction could save the government as much as $1.3 trillion over 10 years.
It's the single largest source of revenue that's being used in this tax plan to pay for cuts for individuals and cuts for corporations.
Bob Klopak is co-director of Americans Against Double Taxation. Klopak says the so-called SALT deduction is also really popular. He says about 44 million people use the deduction to lower their federal tax bill. SALT is particularly popular in wealthy Democratic states like New York and California.
People who take advantage of this are going to be those that have high state and local tax burdens.
That's Jeremy Horpital. He is an assistant professor of economics at the University of Central Arkansas.
Most of the benefits go to people earning over $100,000.
And they don't just live in Democratic districts. Here's Bob Klopak again.
There are, a substantial number of congressional districts, many held by Republicans, where there are very significant numbers of taxpayers who currently claim this deduction.
And taxpayers are also voters, which members of Congress will have to keep in mind as they weigh their desire for tax cuts with the risks of what it takes to pay for them. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, we had a tech boom. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A few years ago, oil prices were hitting record highs. A barrel of West Texas Intermediate crude went for more than $100 back in the summer of 2014. But then there was a fracking boom in the U.S., an oil supply glut, and prices collapsed, driving many producers out of business. Oil prices are now hovering around $50 a barrel. And today, oil companies Exxon and Chevron both announced big profits. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath explains how oil companies are adjusting to the new normal.
During the boom time, the oil and gas industry was fat and happy and a little bit complacent.
When oil was, $90 to $100 per barrel, everywhere where you drilled, you were going to make money.
Robert Thummel manages energy investments for Tortoise Capital Advisors. He says high prices encouraged expensive new ventures, like drilling in the Arctic or the Canadian oil sands. That didn't make sense after prices tanked. Todd Staples is president of the Texas Oil and Gas Association.
Necessity is the mother of invention in any industry, and I think producers, in order to survive during this downturn and very competitive market, have done some basic things.
Like layoffs and putting projects on hold. But, he says, they've also gotten smarter about developing only the projects that'll produce high volumes for low costs. That's led to a funny new term getting popular in oil circles, the break-even point.
Well, for us, it's absolutely critical.
Rob Thummel says in his world, breaking even means something different.
When we refer to break even, we're referring to not only traditional revenues and costs, but that they earn an economic profit that they can turn around and pay to us as shareholders.
When an oil company can cover its costs and pay out its dividends, it's breaking even. Most analysts agree that oil companies these days can hit that point with prices between $50 and $60 a barrel. Thummel says rising prices would certainly be welcome, but for now, oil executives accept that this is the new reality. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
CVS is reportedly offering $66 billion to buy health insurer Aetna. And there's a lot at play here. But one reason behind the bid may be concern that Amazon is eyeing the prescription drug market. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch reported Amazon has approval to be a wholesale drug distributor in at least 12 states. Earlier this year, Amazon jumped into the grocery market, you might remember, buying up Whole Foods. It also wants to drop packages inside your house. And Amazon's disruption of retail overall seems to be working. The company announced way better than expected quarterly sales numbers yesterday. For more, we have Spencer Soper with us now from Bloomberg. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's start with Amazon's seeming interest in the drug industry. What do you expect there?
There's a lot of speculation around it. This is most likely tied to their business-to-business end of things, where they actually want to supply offices with office supplies, factories with parts, and then also, you know, hospitals, doctor's offices, dentist's offices. It looks more likely a business supply operation than retail pharmacy operation.
So maybe not where I go get my penicillin.
Not yet. But that's the speculation, is that they'll ultimately get into the retail pharmacy business, and that their purchase of Whole Foods just intensified that, because so many other supermarkets and big box stores that sell groceries also have pharmacies in them.
Between drugs, groceries, Amazon's making a push into fashion. Where else do you think Amazon's going to go? What other industries might it have its eye on?
Well, what we just talked about, the business marketplace is a big one, and that's actually a lot bigger. You know, it's a very broad category: a dentist's office, a doctor's office, a hospital, a university. All of these places need supplies. And unlike shoppers still like to go to the store. Business people would really love to avoid having to run out and do an errand and buy things. And a lot of that ordering is still done the old-fashioned way, kind of Dunder Mifflin paper people type office type thing, you know,
right.
Phone calls and paper order forms and faxes. So there's a lot of opportunity for Amazon to disrupt that space, and also would lend itself probably to a higher ceiling in terms of the number of transactions that would go online.
If you're in one of these Dunder Mifflins of the world who's made your living selling business supplies to businesses, how do you try to prepare for Amazon's move into that space?
Well, a lot of them already are, and, you know, you're trying to embrace digital as much as you can. So Amazon is best at replenishment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need these certain things over and over again. Where they're not so great is on solutions. So that's where a lot of these business-to-business suppliers, if they're in the business of helping you solve a problem, you know you need something, you're not sure exactly what you need, you might need to speak to someone. Amazon's not good at that. You don't really get Amazon on the phone to walk through a transaction. So that's where a lot of those businesses are going to have to focus on to maintain their advantage.
And what's Amazon's end game? What do they want?
They want to sell everything to everybody. And that's not just buying things and reselling things. It's also being a middleman in e-commerce. And that puts them in the middle of a tremendous amount of businesses, and just kind of gets the Amazon tentacles reaching further and wider into our economy.
Spencer Soper from Bloomberg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up,
my father always said he'd know that mother was ready to do him in if she served him a meal out of a box.
How those meals out of a box became dinner. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 33 points, 0.1%, to close at 23,434. The Nasdaq added 144 points, 2.2%, to finish at 6,701. And the S&P 500 gained 20 points, 0.8%, to end at 2,581. If you want a snapshot of the differing fortunes of U.S. companies, today's the day. In one corner, tech, all the big players posted stronger than expected earnings. Alphabet clicked up 4.25%. Amazon share was at a record high today. In another corner, we've got traditional retail. JCPenney slashed its sales and profit forecasts. Its share price dropped 14.7%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.41%. You're listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. Reining in federal regulations is a major item on the to-do list of those in power right now. In Congress?
Ending the culture of overregulation. It's going to take more than a few months, but we have made a good start.
And in the White House.
Since taking office, I've signed one action after another to eliminate job-killing regulations that stand in a way.
Those are the voices of President Trump and Speaker of the House Paul Ryan. But how did this country become so regulation-focused in the first place? Chrissy Clark from our Wealth and Poverty Desk explores that question in the new season of Marketplace's documentary podcast, The Uncertain Hour. Today, Chrissy brings us a story of how one homemaker's life intersected with the growing regulation of something very basic to all of our lives, food.
By the time Ruth Desmond was a grandmother in the 1970s, she'd earned a reputation as a powerful consumer activist in our nation's capital. Newspapers called her the, quote, terror of Washington, who spit in the corporate eye.
She did, but nicely.
Ruth Desmond died in 1988 in her 80s, but this woman with the laugh, Janet Swager, knew her well. Way before Ruth was a grandmother or a food activist.
I'm her angel of a daughter. She always called me her angel.
Janet was Ruth's only child. They were always close. Apparently, they had the same laugh. And growing up in the 1950s, Janet spent a lot of time with her mom in the kitchen of their small brick house in Arlington, Virginia. Janet still lives there now. She's 76.
When you look at this room and picture your mom, what would she be doing in it? Where would she be?
Oh, she'd be busy with her blender or her bread maker. You know, her oven would have a roast in it. My father always said he'd know that mother was ready to do him in if she served him a meal out of a box.
And that was only kind of a joke. Ruth really did see food and cooking as matters of life and death because of something that happened in 1955. Ruth's husband, Gordon, Janet's dad,
had come down with bladder cancer.
He was young, in his 40s.
I remember him going in for surgeries and all, and we'd go visit at the hospital.
Before one surgery, Janet remembers, the doctors were talking about the general anesthesia they were going to use on her dad. Her mom overheard them and explained that he'd had a bad reaction to it in an earlier surgery.
Stopped his heart for 3 minutes.
Ruth said instead of general anesthesia, he needed a spinal block, but the doctors ignored her.
So she actually rode the gurney into the surgical room. Laying across his body, saying, you will not give him anesthesia.
That's the kind of person she was.
The kind of person she was. She was determined. So there you go. That was how she looked at everything.
As for Janet's dad's cancer.
Fortunately, he got most of it out. Cut a lot of it out. But mother then wanted it to stay out because bladder cancer is one of those that can reoccur.
And so Ruth started reading up on the latest science about cancer and its potential causes, which led her to these studies on
the potential role of chemical additives and pesticide residues in food.
Angie Boyce is a bioethicist at Johns Hopkins who's written about Ruth Desmond. She says Ruth started looking into the emerging science about these new chemicals that, in the last few decades, food manufacturers were adding to food, and studies that linked some of them to cancer in lab animals. The science was still uncertain, but it raised questions for Ruth about how safe the food was that she was feeding her family. And more importantly, who was supposed to be in charge of figuring out what was safe? And so,
at that point, and I think, you know, this is so, like, this is so Ruth Desmond, she calls the FDA.
They're named the Food and Drug Administration, after all. So Ruth wants to know what they're doing about these chemicals.
And they tell her, if you're interested in this, why don't you, you know, you're local.
She was in Arlington, Virginia, remember, just down the road from the FDA.
Why don't you attend this hearing we're going to have on food additives?
And so Ruth does. The FDA was having these hearings on food additives because at the time, food was in the middle of a complete transformation, prompted by
America goes to war.
Peter Hutt teaches food and drug law at Harvard. Since the 1960s, he's been a lawyer for some of the biggest food companies around.
During World War II, the food science industry went to work and totally changed the American food supply because they were making food to feed our troops all over the world. So that's how the food supply began to change. It became to be a processed food, an engineered food, if you will.
When the war ended, the two biggest industries left standing in America were the chemical industry and the food industry.
People were experimenting with all sorts of chemicals used to preserve foods.
Suzanne Junod is a historian at the FDA.
Honestly, no one knew if they were safe or not, in what amounts they might or might not be safe.
And then, in early November of 1959, just before Thanksgiving, this happened.
We interrupt this program for a special news bulletin.
The FDA announced that inspectors had discovered a crop of cranberries contaminated with a weed killer known to cause cancer in animals. According to federal regulations, farmers were supposed to spray the chemical long enough before harvest that it had time to wear off the berries. But apparently, some bogs got sprayed too late. This was especially jarring for Ruth, Janet says, because
Father liked her to make her famous cranberry jelly from scratch.
The government made a public announcement, warned that if you didn't know exactly where your cranberries came from, this year you should keep them off the Thanksgiving table. And the nation freaked out. Overnight, cranberries disappeared from store shelves. Some states banned the sale of cranberries altogether. Janet remembers her mom reading about it all in the paper.
It was a scandal. They had sprayed the cranberries, and here they are laying out in the grocery stores. And then you find out what they've done to the food before it even gets to the grocery store. And she said, oh my God, you know, I'm killing my husband when I think I'm trying to help him.
Housewives panicked about what to do without their favorite holiday condiment. This song hit the airwaves about the brand new worry all over the nation.
All cranberry got contamination. If you want to be sure of not get sick, don't touch a cranberry with a 10-foot stick.
But the FDA got blamed for overreacting. Richard Nixon and JFK, both running for president, flouted government warnings and very publicly consumed cranberries on the campaign trail. Cranberry growers argued that people would have to eat carloads of cranberries for the pesticide residue to do any harm, and hanged an FDA official in effigy.
Cranberry, cranberry blue.
But while lots of Americans were cursing the FDA, Ruth was cheering.
And said, I'm going to do something about this.
And when there were cranberry hearings in 1959, an organization she'd recently co-founded, the Federation of Homemakers, made a statement defending how the FDA handled the situation, condemning those in the cranberry industry whose, quote, sole concern seems to be a financial one. But this was only a dress rehearsal for something much bigger in Ruth Desmond's future as a consumer activist. Ruth first got wind of this thing when she was sitting in an FDA office and noticed something on the desk, an announcement sparked by a covert action the FDA had recently executed on behalf of peanut butter.
Peanut butter.
To hear more from Chrissy Clark about how Ruth helped change the way we think about food and government regulations through peanut butter, subscribe to the podcast, The Uncertain Hour, wherever you get your podcasts. This final note before we go today, live music on your airplane. Billboard is reporting that Southwest has struck a deal with Warner Music Nashville that'll mean live concerts on flights. Think microphones, guitars, country crooning at 35,000 feet. Apparently, they've been doing this for a while already. And while I hate to play spoilsport here, what about those of us who want to sleep on the plane or just sit quietly with a book? Today, the Dow rose 33 points, 0.1%. The Nasdaq added 144 points, 2.2%, and the S&P 500 gained 20 points, 0.8%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Satara Nieves is the executive producer. Deb Clark is our senior vice president and the general manager. I'm Adrienne Hill. We'll see you on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.